The electronic intifada.
Intifada electronic.
The electronic intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast. In Oakland, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with the Electronic Intifada. In this podcast, we'll hear part of a recent talk by Professor Stephen Saleta on Palestine, the media, and free speech, given as part of annual Israeli Apartheid Week events in Montreal, Canada. The Electronic Intifada recently reported that celebrated public intellectual Dr. Cornel West canceled a lecture at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign to protest the firing of Stephen Saleta. West, a professor at Princeton University, joins a boycott of the University of Illinois by thousands of scholars outraged over the violation of Saleta's right to free speech. Saleta is suing university officials, trustees, and donors for firing him from a tenured faculty position in the American Indian Studies program. The complaint contends that the dismissal was motivated by university officials' disagreement with tweets Saleta made criticizing Israel's assault on Gaza last summer that killed more than 2,200 Palestinians. Quote, "My change of mind in regard to my cancellation of my lecture constitutes a line in the sand I could not cross," West said in a statement released by the Center for Constitutional Rights. West was scheduled to deliver the prestigious 2015 Marjorie Hall Thulin Lecture on the Profound Desire for Justice. Last week, after an attempt by the university to dismiss Saleta's case, his legal team has responded, saying that because of the university's violations of his constitutional rights, Saleta's First Amendment claim must be allowed to proceed. And now here's a talk given by Stephen Saleta at a recent Israeli Apartheid Week event in Montreal, along with CKUT reporter and producer Gretchen King and Emmett Livingstone, a graduate student and commentary editor with the McGill Daily. Many thanks to Gretchen King and McGill University for this audio.
Hi, I'm Steve. I'll interlace autobiographical information in my comments about media, but I'm not directly involved in any sort of media production, but for quite a while I've both in my scholarship and political writing have been analyzing media discourses around Israel, Palestine, and one thing that you see consistently in at least in corporate media and to some degree in progressive or even leftist media, although it's really beginning to change, is that coverage tends to have very little, if any at all, context of colonization, particularly settler colonization, and certainly very little historical framing of the existence of a Palestinian nation that was destroyed in the first half of the 20th century, you know, culminating, of course, in 1948, and then continuing, of course, up until today. And so you'll see questions being approached as if there is an equitable, you know, distribution of power between the Israelis and Palestinians. Oh, they'll raise moral questions about rockets and tunnels and these sorts of things as if on their own, even without context, it's somehow an interesting or useful question to ask in light of the massive destruction of property and lives that Israel regularly undertakes. But what I mean by a lack of context, we're not, you know, it's not like, you know, France and Italy are, you know, having at it, right? You know, they seem roughly equal to me, I don't know. I would use the example of Canada and the U.S., but that seems a little bit far-fetched. But in other words, these are not two, you know, modern industrial nations with advanced militaries, you know, having some sort of timeless spat that has something to do with atavistic hatred between Jews and Muslims, But that's the way that, the narrative is often framed, or that sort of narrative anyway is implied. And I see, hear this when I'm interacting, you know, with people sometimes in public events. You see how this kind of media narrative has, you know, some primacy. So I'll lay out you know, a very well rehearsed, very well supported narrative about you know, Israel's many war crimes, both recently and in the past. And people will say, well, what about rockets? You know, what about condemning Palestinian violence? And that assumes a type of equivalence there that in reality simply doesn't exist. What about colonization? What about the fact that, you know, 1.8, 1.9 million people are crammed into a space twice the size physically of Washington, D.C.? What about the fact that mainstream Israeli politicians constantly use genocidal language to describe the so-called Palestine problem? Things like mowing the lawn and putting Gaza on a diet, you know, talking openly about demography in ways that really inform a type of eugenicist politics. And therefore, you can't talk like that, then undertake a bombing campaign of an entrapped population, right, and not have people logically deduce or infer that the point of the violence is simply to harm people and to make them suffer. That's the result of Israel's own mainstream political discourse, and I emphasize mainstream because, you know, Naftali Bennett, you know, the Netanyahu, you know, these are Lieberman, Avigdor Lieberman. These are not fringe political figures in Israel. These are not the David Dukes of Israel. These are people who are central to Israeli, you know, Israeli policy, to the formation of Israeli policy. And so this is what I see in media, and I've seen it consistently, an inability or an unwillingness to engage any sort of context that might allow readers to better understand why this conflict is happening and why it's not a particularly germane question morally or politically to ask, you know, what about Hamas's unwillingness to recognize Israel, as if that's a question that has anything to do with the origin of the conflict, a question that has anything to do with the current reality of the conflict, or that has anything to do with the fact that even I, somebody who's attuned to this stuff, is stupidly referring to it as a conflict when it's not actually a conflict at all. You know, it's an act of colonization. It's an act of military occupation. You know, I know I'm preaching to the choir, but these are the sorts of things that the narratives that you see getting recycled and sort of maintained through particular discursive practices. And then recently, you know, ever since I got fired at the University of Illinois, I've had the strange opportunity of, in many cases, being the subject of news stories, and that's kind of given me a different understanding of how these things sort of work and how your own comments can get spliced and decontextualized in ways that supplement an extant narrative. And so I guess these are some of the things that I feel able to discuss in some way. And just really quickly, I wanted to respond to Emmett's comments, because it's all too familiar. This is somebody who is serious about his job and who is principled and who has a good understanding of Israel-Palestine, and you see the tremendous amount of fortitude it requires to stand your ground around this kind of nonsense. You think that's the case for most, you know, op-ed editors or editorial page editors? Of course not. They don't want to deal with this stuff. They don't have good politics in the first place, especially in corporate media. You don't become you don't become Thomas Friedman by being sharp. You know, you don't get the You don't get to run the op-ed page of the Washington Post, you know, if you have good politics, you know, or the Boston Globe or any of the other Politico, right? You know, I know I'm stuck in an old media paradigm here, right? Politico, Slate, whatever. I don't even know what the corporate websites are. But the point is, there is a tremendous amount of pressure put on people in these sorts of positions, and if you're not predisposed to doing your job in a principled manner in the first place, you can see how easy it would be just to cave in and to shut off voices in support of Palestine or the Palestinians and simply provide the space. And this outside of the fact that most of these editors anyway are ideologically invested in Zionism in the first place. The very first article I ever wrote for anything that might be considered major was in 2001. It was a month before 9/11. That's how I remember the date. In the Houston Chronicle, which is a sort of a mid-major newspaper in a major city, right? But it doesn't have a nationwide distribution, right? People in Houston maybe are going to read it. And the op-ed editor told me, because I blindly submitted it, and he contacted me and said, I want to run this, which was shocking. And he told me straight up, I don't publish these sorts of things because of the headache that comes with it. You know, I just don't want to deal with it. And that was sort of an eye-opening moment. But it also tells us the type of expectation that comes with such a long-standing position of social and political privilege. You know, there's one newspaper on a university campus, and it's a good university campus, and I'm sure it's a good newspaper, right? But it's absolutely intolerable to Zionists, right, that even one paper wouldn't be fully in their thrall. They have the Times, they have the Post, they have the Globe and Mail, they have everything, right? They've always had everything. Serious, you know, but it's the sort of precedent that it might set. If the McGill newspaper steps out of line and manages to get away with it, why, good golly, other newspapers might follow suit, and we don't want people to get the wrong idea. So, you know, these are, I guess, my opening thoughts on media for whatever they're worth.
You're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. Visit us online at electronicintifada.net or follow us on Twitter at Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
Intifada Electronica.
Intifada Electronica.
The Electronic Intifada.
Professor Salaita is a professor of literature. Okay, did you get it? Right.
Sorry. Sorry.
You know, because I noticed you, like, skirting, like, the introduction, right? Who was hired for a position in American Indian Studies. He works in comparative colonization, right? So on literature of indigenous peoples in North America and Palestinian and other Arab and Arab American literature, and was fired from that position, which is a tenured position at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign that he alluded to, right, allegedly over tweets about Gaza from this summer. So just in case anybody doesn't Google.
I feel like I implied all of those things.
But, you know, just in case somebody just wandered in.
Sure, okay,
you know,
no, that's fair.
You know,
that's good, thank you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you
want
Yeah, I can respond to a couple of things and ask questions at the same time. I think it's interesting that both of you bring up, like, narrative, because I think that narratives that get set in Israel by the mainstream politicians and the discourses there very much set the tone of things here, and even that trickles into so-called good politics spaces of, like, community media, where we broadcast to amplify the voices of the other points of view that aren't heard in the mainstream media, so it's Palestinians speaking in their terms, in their language, and so when we aired this Nakba broadcast and constantly referred to 1948 as the Nakba, the complaint that we received from the CRTC, including all sorts of other examples, trying to say this broadcast was anti-Semitic, they specifically cited the use of the word Nakba as anti-Semitic because it was critical of the national story of Israel. So the CRTC is the commission that regulates radio here in Canada, along with television and other things as well. The same thing with regard to Occupied. We have a national campus community radio news program. The headline in August that we tried to run about the war that was happening on Gaza at that time was just trying to refer to Gaza as occupied land. And that word occupied was edited out by the national coordinator who was working out of the National Association office, and that should never happen. This is a collaboratively produced program. Editorial content is controlled by the people who are producing it. There's no hierarchy. This is an this is a space that's organized in a collective way, in a participatory way. It's the editorial mandate is anti-oppressive, supports decolonization movements, supports all sorts of social justice movements, and the editor still took the lead of editing out the word occupied because she was basically told by someone who didn't have the power to say this even, but is the executive director of this huge national association who's got 85 members in rural and urban communities, lots of new members who are new to the association. Oh, our new members in small towns don't know the history, don't know the context of Palestine, so you can't refer to Gaza as occupied because they don't have that context, right? Context is crucial in media, and they don't have it, so therefore we can't say it. And that's so wrong for so many reasons, in addition to the fact that this is a headline, in addition to the fact that they edited it out without consent, and all the, like, that was one of those conversations where you feel like you should be not having to say this, and at the same time screaming that this should never, ever happen, and just being really, really upset in that moment. And of course, they replaced the file, like, they had to basically re-upload the program and correct what they had edited out to not censor out the word occupied. So these kinds of debates around what things are called happen even in community media because of the power of these narratives, even in spaces like community media is rooted in social justice movements. It's rooted in struggles for human rights. This is where community radio was born over 100 years ago. So this work has been there for a really long time, but it's never a work and a project that will be completed until Palestine is liberated, until Palestinian people have self-determination. This work will continue. And so one of the questions I had posed to Emmett last night when we talked about today was the strategies that people doing this kind of work need and the support that we need from others, because it's not sustainable to take on 50 and 40 email chains alone. So there's got to be ways in which you can act. And so I was asking for at least Emmett and Stephen, if I had talked with you, I would have said the same thing, to think of strategies you'd like to see in terms of support from others, from readers, from people who support your work, from the McGill community specifically. So if you have any thoughts around that.
Please. Yeah. I mean, a thank you email is always nice. it's nice to know that people are reading and they're engaging in what you're reading. Letters also are nice. You can publish letters and say, I support this article for X, Y, Z reason. It also pushes back against the accusation that you're representing a very minority, crazy, extremist view, which is often what people say. Other than that, I think, at least for, I mean, I can only really speak for the Daily, maybe not CKUT, but I think educational workshops would be useful. I think often people who are dealing with these issues are the people who are interested in the issues, and you have to deal with other people who aren't quite so interested and will often try and tone down the language, which amounts to self-censorship. So, I mean, you brought it up as well. We do use the term occupied Palestinian territory, but I don't think we've ever used the term ethnic cleansing, for example, in our paper, which I think is a bad thing. I mean, we're student media. We're probably the most free. This is like the time at which we're the most free to write what we can. And even at this position, we're self-censoring.
Yeah.
And I think that has to do with a lack, maybe, of exposure to some of these discourses. So I guess greater organization, more contact with groups who are working in these areas.
Yeah, I not being in the directly involved in the business, so to speak, and it's weird to refer to it as a business because it's certainly not paying for our private planes, is it? But in the industry, that has the same crappy connotation. Anyway, not
in
being
the
involved
struggle?
In the struggle. There we go. Yeah, being having a peripheral relationship.
Yeah.
With media, both corporate and alternative. I would second Emmett's point that the thank you email is actually a really wonderful gesture. The thank you email is not going to liberate Palestine, okay? But just at a basic human level, I can't tell you after I got fired how much it meant to me to get a I hear you, I support you, keep it up. That that was nourishment. It really was. And when I've written things that have been controversial, which has happened a bunch of times, you know, when just hearing from people, it helps keep you going. It's just a wonderful thing. So that's just kind of a suggestion. But in terms of the broader picture I think of it what Gretchen raises as I hope it's not taking it off course from where she wants the analysis to exist, but it makes me think closely about how much energy we even want to waste on traditional or corporate media versus the question of sort of cultivating our own media sites. In other words, do we really need, you know, the New York Times anymore, right? Do we even do we need the stodgy old money publications? I don't know. Maybe we do. I don't. It's honestly, for me, it's an open question, but it is one to think about in terms of media strategy. We have tons of high quality online sites now, and I find actually, you know, people think it's ridiculous that a grown man or a grown person uses Twitter, but I find tons of awesome news on Twitter all of the time. People who are giving you a direct narrative of what they're seeing in Aleppo or Damascus or Khan Yunis or whatever, right? They're giving you a direct report from the ground or pointing you to articles, right, that you might not otherwise encounter through a regular Google search, and that certainly aren't going to be picked up by, you know, CNN or the CBC or whatever. And so I think, again, and this is probably relevant especially to what you're doing, Gretchen, the ways maybe that we can be engaged in building and supporting and helping to find money for alternate media, you know, whose mission and whose vision, both journalistically and politically and socially, you know, looks very different than a, you know, sort of a for-profit entity, you know, owned by one of the seven conglomerates that owns every bit of big time media in the world right now. Does that make sense?
It makes total sense, and uh-huh. I hear you on that, because part of what I'm really interested in is because it's sort of building on the media activist movements uh-huh. that we've seen kind of take off. You know, there's so much happening now, and almost too much happening in isolation. And that's where I think it becomes crucial to basically bring all these different efforts together mm-hmm. and create mass platforms okay. to replace the mainstream media. Mm-hmm. The value of mainstream media, yes, there's no point in trying to break those walls at the New York Times. We're never going to get ethnic cleansing in there, as we can have as many, you know, unofficial sources saying this or that. Like, ethnic cleansing will never appear. Palestinian voices will never have the same level of authority or space in those papers, or those kinds of spaces. So I think it's really about these alternative mass platforms that we can build, and this is where I think joint initiatives are really important. So it'd be great to see CKUT in the Daily, because CKUT has had a history of having Palestinian programming, has connections and all sorts of relationships in the community beyond campus. The broadcast that we did for the 60th anniversary of the Nakba was a great opportunity to go and speak with people who are alive at that time and told their own personal narratives. All of that could have been transcribed and made available in the Daily, or represented in multimedia form on your website to share with your community of readers. But we need to build bigger communities through our media, bigger audiences that are listening to us, and we don't have to do that in isolation. It's not about the Daily getting bigger or CKT getting bigger. It's about us uniting our resources and acting together and basically using our collective power and spaces and volunteers to further amplify the cause. And so I'd like to see definitely more of that as we go forward, not just creating more alternative media opportunities, but creating mass platforms, but also ensuring that those mass platforms are rooted directly to people creating and generating media in Palestine.
That was a portion of a recent speech given by Stephen Saleta, along with Gretchen King of CKUT Radio and Emmett Livingstone of McGill University. Thank you so much to Gretchen King and McGill University for the use of this audio. For more, visit electronicintifada.net. And that's it for the Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features, and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net. You can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and on behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.